Well, it's been an unforgettable week, hasn't it? One I suspect few, if any of us, have ever experienced before, where the most powerful men in the world seem to order anything they can think of, from bailouts to rate cuts, and can only watch helpless and powerless as they seem to affect little or nothing. And yet here we are this morning, heading back thousands of years to an Egypt none of us have experienced, to a people whose names we can't pronounce. These are stressful, uncertain days, and we're going to give our time back there. To these opening four chapters of the book of Exodus, the description of a slave people in chapter 1, Moses, the early years in chapter 2, his remarkable escape at birth from the bulrushes, being brought up in the Egyptian palace, the way he identifies with his own Hebrew people, murders an Egyptian and flees the country. And then in chapters 3 and 4, his call by God at the burning bush. Well, you don't have to be ultra-sensitive to work out there's a clash of gears, isn't there, between London 2008 and that. And yet, I wonder if you noticed that there is something very contemporary about this story. I mean, if I speak of it as stories from the streets, then it is our streets that I mean. Stories you can see lived out on the streets of London any day of the month, and some of them in any modern capital city. I mean, take the first of them, for example, what I've called the immigrant underclass. Foreigners caught at the bottom of the pile. And that's what these Israelites are, isn't it? As they drop off the bottom of the social scale. They're needed. You noticed in verse 11, they built the store cities for the Pharaoh, but they're feared as well, both at the same time. And it happens all along, doesn't it, with almost any wave of immigrants from, it's happened in this country, from West Indian bus drivers to Polish plumbers. We wonder how the country's going to cope without them, and we complain about them taking our jobs all at the same time. And it doesn't stop with complaining either. And it didn't stop with complaining in Exodus chapter 1, did it? I mean, look at verse 11. They put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor. Or verse 14, they made their lives bitter with hard labor in brick and mortar and with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. And when that wasn't enough, well, the violence started. And the midwives are instructed, you know, if it's a boy, kill him. And brave midwives that they are, they refuse. They get summoned to explain why they're not reaching their NHS targets. And you have to admire their quick-wittedness with their answer, don't you, when it comes in verse 19. Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They're vigorous, and they give birth before the midwives arrive. 10 out of 10 for that. The trouble is, if you're a government with the kind of majority that Pharaoh had, you simply make the order more explicit. And that's what happens in verse 22. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people. Every boy that's born, you must throw into the Nile. Well, there's the first story, if you like. Here's the second, because if you look more closely at the story, you discover it isn't just the history of any old foreigner. These are God's people. This is another contemporary scenario being lived out, what we call today the marginalized church. Now, once theirs was a voice of immense power in the land, and their leader had the ear of the king, theirs was the view that shaped public policy. Then verse 8 of chapter 1, a new king, who did not know about Joseph, came to power in Egypt. You see, now when it comes to the public square, to the life of the nation, their influence is all a thing of the past. Their voices are almost silenced, their ideas dismissed, their convictions despised. God's people, like the church today, are left to live out their lives in a culture increasingly hostile to them. And when someone does rise up, as Moses did in chapter 2, and challenges the trend, then, as now, we watch and discover that God's people may be marginalized and sidelined, but the church can still be comfortable like that. It can still be wary of a leader who hasn't risen through the normal channels. It can still ask, who made you ruler and judge over us? It can be worried he'll rock the boat, make life more uncomfortable for them, so they turn their backs on him and lapse back into a passive insignificance. I don't think that's a far-fetched idea in 21st century Britain. Or then, there's yet another story being played out on our streets. It's there in the life of any passerby if you could only see it, but it doesn't come out in a photo. It's what I've called the spiritual slave. I'm like pretty much everyone here. We've known in our lives freedoms and privilege that few in the rest of the world have known. Certainly I've never known the economic deprivation of these chapters, a deprivation that's commonplace in so many parts of the world today. And I don't imagine that even this economic crisis is likely to reduce us to those levels. Yet, in a significant way, I have stood where these people have stood, and so have you. I've known oppression and slavery, and what it is to be trapped by sin, and unable to break free of it. Locked into the lie, once freely told, and then bound to repeat. Or the relationship you know to be wrong, but how do you break free of it? Or just caught up in the greed that's found us all out in these last weeks. And suddenly helpless to know where its consequences are going to take us or to change them in any way. It's naive to imagine that greed is the sole province of bankers. Whoever commits sin, Jesus said, is a slave to sin. And some of us have been all too aware of the death sentence cutting us off from the living God. That's all part and parcel of this slavery. Because you see, this history in Exodus is also a picture of an even deeper history, and this rescue from slavery in Exodus is a picture of the rescue from our spiritual, sinful slavery. Only it begins not with rescue, but when you look to the end of chapter 2, with groaning. Look at verse 23. During that long period, these opening couple of chapters actually have raced through nearly 400 years, the king of Egypt died, and the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out. See, I don't know which of the stories from the streets you associate yourself with, but they all lead here, don't they? The groaning of someone who's helpless, unable to save ourselves, crying out, needing some God to act. And the stories from the streets, with the groans and the cries, reach their decisive moment when we seem to stumble across what I've called the God for the groans. The God for the groans. Look at verse 23 of chapter 2. You see, the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning. Was the groan a prayer? Was the cry for help directed to anyone in particular? I mean, it almost reads as if God was like GCHQ in Cheltenham with all those listening devices monitoring communications around the world, and he picks this up. But watch how the writer takes it on. Look at the verbs. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. God heard. God remembered. Now, don't get that wrong. Don't imagine it's as if God was sort of old and doddery. suffering from plenty of memory loss. Hadn't noticed a thing all those years, and then one day the clouds lifted from his mind, and for a moment at least all became clear again, and at last God remembered. It can feel like that. It did feel like that for the Israelites in their slavery. It's why these two chapters are written with almost no mention of God at all until now, but it wasn't like that. You see, he is the God for the groans because he is the God of the covenant. He heard, God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. Now, more than anything else, I need to see this if I don't want my understandable groaning to slip into faithless despair. There is nothing vague about the God who hears the cry for help. Please don't reduce him to those silly platitude phrases, a higher being, some divine power. No, this is the God with a covenant, the God who promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God with a track record, and it's not forgotten by him. And it's all on track. His promises can be relied on. You'll have to go and do the research for yourself. But the aging, childless Abraham was promised back in Genesis 12, I will make you into a great nation. And now in Exodus 1, what do we discover? They're breeding like rabbits. Or however the Hebrew puts that politely. Well, you see it in verse 7, really, don't you? It says, the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. And Abraham had even been told this slavery was built into the covenant promise. You'll find it in Genesis 15. The Lord God says, know for certain, that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they'll be enslaved and ill-treated 400 years, but I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterwards they will come out with great possessions. So who's forgotten the covenant? Not the Lord. It's folly to imagine that being God's people is the guarantee of a cushy life. The covenant with Abraham, it included slavery. The covenant with Christ involved the cross. The covenant with the church includes persecution, my friends, not just marginalized. You can understand the groaning, but actually it's the covenant fulfilled, not the covenant forgotten. And more than that, the rescuer is in place already. Been miraculously saved in that basket in the reeds on the Nile. He's been trained and educated by the very royal household he'll defeat. He's made his big decision. He chose to be ill-treated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as of greater value than the treasures of Egypt, Hebrews 11 tells us. Oh, Moses may have seen his rebellion as a one-day wonder, which left him as a murderer and a failure and an exile. But God is just about to call him into action, to fulfill his covenant promise of the great escape. Like the ultimate rescuer, Jesus, he will save the people in spite of their rejection of him. And when God speaks to him out of the burning bush, you notice he does so as his covenant God. Look how he introduces himself at the bottom of the page, chapter 3 and verse 6. Then he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. See, as always, the fog is not over God's eyes and memory, it's over ours. And as it lifts, it's not as if God climbs into the driving seat and takes control. It's that we see he is there, and he's been there all the time. You turn over the page to the end of chapter 4. And you read as the people of Israel are told all that Moses has heard. When they heard, the very last verse there, verse 31, when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and worshipped. What changed the groans at the end of chapter 2 to the worship at the end of chapter 4? Their eyes were opened to see their God. The God of the covenant. He's the God with a heart. You don't have to turn back a page now. It's there in verse 7 of chapter 3, right at the top of the left-hand page if you're in a church Bible. The Lord said, I've indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of the slave drivers, and I'm concerned about their suffering. Now, you and I, we can see and hear and be concerned and even shed a tear and do nothing, can't we? Simply get caught up in the next heart-wrenching news story. But when God sees and hears and is concerned, it always leads to action. So, verse 8, I have come down to rescue. That's God. That's his heart. And even if you haven't already guessed where it's going, you can't be surprised when you read later of how God reveals himself in Jesus, and we're told, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And you read it and you say, of course. Yeah, that fits. Typical. Just like this God. So now he says to Moses, verse 10, go, I'm sending you. And Moses says, verse 11, said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh? Who indeed? Just a failure whose face is on every wanted poster in Egypt. So God says, verse 12, I will be with you. Well, of course he does. I mean, this God doesn't face the hurt and then step back and send someone else to take the heat. I will be with you. He doesn't look danger in the face, step back, and send a minion instead. Go, he says. Go, he still says to his people. Go, go to dangerous places. Go into all the world. Make disciples of all the nations. And I will be with you till the end of the age. The God for the groans. The God of the covenant. The God with a heart. The God with a name. You see the strange next section from verses 13 to 22 where Moses says to God, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what's his name? Then what do I tell them? Now again, don't read it wrongly. It's not a question of an ID card. You know, don't go and play the policeman with God. Excuse me, sir. What's your name, please? You know, have you got a driving license? Or a utility bill? Now, the name simply means the character. What's he like? What kind of God are you? God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you're to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. I am, I exist, not like the idols. And next week we'll see the clash of those gods. I am, I'm present, I'm here, I'm with you. I am who I am. I am who I reveal myself to be. You want to know what I'm like? Well, keep watching this space. Keep us tuned to history. You know, do you want God all boxed up, neatly packaged, some simple one-line definition? He doesn't come that way. He's far more dynamic than that. You know what he's like when you see him in action. When you hear his promises and watch him keep them. And they already knew something of them. They can look to the past and know their God's character. All right, verse 15. Say to the Israelites, the Lord, Yahweh, shortened, packed all into one word version of everything that's meant by verse 14. The Lord, the God of your fathers. Here it is again, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. Now he's the one who sent me. This is my name forever. The God of those covenant promises is good for them for all time. He's not a figure stuck in the past. And again in verse 16 he reminds them of how they know him. the God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob, and he promises what they're about to discover of him in verse 17, how I promised to bring you up out of your misery in Egypt and into a land flowing with milk and honey. I am has sent me to you. And in years to come, his character's not going to change. But his promises of rescue get applied across the board, rescue from meaninglessness and sin and death and judgment. I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will never walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me will live even though he dies. I am the good shepherd. And the good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. Yeah, the God for the groans, the God of the covenant, the God with a heart, the God with a name, the God with the power. If you had your suspicions that God was keener on this plan than Moses, well, by the time he reached chapter 4, they really are growing. You know, he's thinking of another line now. What if they don't believe me, he says. I mean, what sign can I give them? So God gives him signs to validate the messenger. There's the staff and the snake where Moses throws the staff on the ground and it turns into a snake, which is the symbol of Egyptian royal authority. But Moses can grab it by the tail and turn it back into a staff again. Yes, he's got control of it. Or then there's the hand which comes out of his coat diseased and goes in again and comes out clean. Here's the one who's going to lead the unclean nation to be cleansed. Or the water that turns into blood, a reminder that rescue will inevitably involve death and judgment. But even after all of that, you see, you get to verse 10 of chapter 4, and there's Moses saying to the Lord, O Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you've spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and tongue. I'm not up to it. You know, he's just been given a bag full of tricks and he's not up to it. And you see how God answers? He says, you are Moses. He says, look, Moses, look, it's time you just saw yourself properly. Stop having such low self-esteem. You're perfectly capable. Now, I rush far too quickly into those kind of answers. There's nothing flattering in what God says, is there? He just says, verse 11, Moses, who made your mouth? Who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or mute? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak and will teach you what to say. This is the Creator God speaking. The one who puts us together and knows how the mouth works. Moses, who's going to do the work? I'm with you. I'll help you speak. I'll teach you what to say. Friends, if we haven't understood this truth, that this living God is the one behind those he raises up and sends out, we'll never understand Christian ministry. It explains why the smoothest talkers can actually have a fruitless ministry. And sometimes the roughest of speakers can have the profoundest of ministries. The God for the groans. The God of the covenant. The God with a heart. The God with a name. The God with the power. The God for the groans. You know, you can see now, really, can't you, how it's going to go all the way to the happy ending. Unless you read verse 13. O Lord, please send someone else to do it. Almost unbelievable if it wasn't in black and white, isn't it? I thought that was just the line that preachers used. And then I find Moses saying it here. And it's not humility anymore, is it? It's disobedience now. And actually, I realize as I think about it, it's not that rare either. I wonder if this isn't a warning for some of us this morning. The God who's been calling you to stand in some way for his people and you realize, as we look at this morning, that you've been saying, send someone else. Thank God Jesus never said that. And so you come to the end of the chapter. And Aaron's brought along to do the speaking for Moses, and verse 29 of chapter 4, Moses and Aaron brought together all the elders of the Israelites, and Aaron told them everything the Lord had said to Moses. He also performed the signs before the people, and they believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and worshipped. You see, what's changed? Their misery hasn't changed. Their God hasn't changed. They've changed. The fog that blinded them to their own God has been lifted. He had seen. He was concerned. He had come down to rescue. Now friends, think about it for a moment, will you? This story was not written for the Exodus generation. Okay, they'd gone through all this. They'd experienced all of this before anyone put pen to paper. It was written for the generations afterwards. It was written for you and me. It was written because it's all too easy to have times when it can feel as if God has forgotten. And we need to remember that His promises are trustworthy. And as these stories get played out on our streets, and the spiritual slavery to sin is lived out in thousands of lives that brush up against us every day of the week. And as God's saying to you and to me, go. Go with the word of rescue. Go, tell of the Lord who is concerned. Go, say the word of the Lord who has come down to rescue. Do we still say, please send someone else? Let's pray. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and worshipped. Gracious God, may we be those who bow down before you this morning and cry to you for forgiveness where we've been faithless, for forgiveness where we've been cowardly. Renew our vision and our confidence in our living God, we pray. For your name's sake. Amen.